I'd like to say a few words about what I call the future of the American dream, and then to have discussion, because I found, Nancy and I were talking about this, what happens at Holden, and I'm all for it and I want to encourage it, is that the best discussions are where the faculty starts off with something, and then we find out what you're interested in and take it from there, without it being planned, because there are so many good resources here that I would like to tap in on those as quickly as possible, and everybody has a chance to express themselves. And we don't have to agree on things. I'm sure we won't on many things, and I don't expect this, that we take a vote at the end and decide, does the American dream have a future or something? Sometimes people have a little difficulty because they would kind of like to come away with sort of a 1, 2, 3 sort of set of solutions to some of the problems. I can only give my favorite example of a pre-medical student who was in my class, and the first discussion we always had, I think Nancy may remember this, is were the Puritans really builders of democracy, or were they religious bigots? You can argue that back and forth. And we talked and talked and talked for a while. Finally the bell rang, and I said, okay, that's it. And he was furious because we didn't settle it. It isn't like a laboratory experiment where you're going in with your cookbook and your little things and you pour in and that. And of course, science people get furious when you call a laboratory manual a cookbook. But, you stir or you take your fetal pig and you cut it up and you dissect and you look and everything else. And there's an answer. There has to be, a solution to this. And you come out of there, or the math class where you come out with an answer to a problem. But we don't have answers, in the sense that there's a final answer which settles the problem once and for all. Because every time we start a discussion in something in this field, like in history or theology or something, we'll probably come out at a different point. And that's what makes it interesting, because it indicates that we are growing and expanding our understanding and our viewpoints with one another. So after, 5-minute preliminary, maybe we should start. Actually, this isn't a leftover topic from the bicentennial, although it might sound like that, because I think many of us have had enough of the bicentennial to last us for maybe another 100 years or so, because it did come out rather commercialized, and there was a marvelous little skit at an extemporaneous theater in Minneapolis that was called Who Will Buy the Bicentennial? And, B-U-I, the bicentennial, and the ultimate, maybe you saw that in Newsweek or Time, the ultimate was you could get a red, white, and blue coffin. I thought that was, that was about it. The bunting or whatever it was inside was in very tasteful red, white, and blue. Rest will probably be a better word for this, along with other things that go along with. I thought that was, just about the extreme. I really don't think, in a little while it'll really make much difference, but if it is orange and black or whatever, but if that's what people want, that in a way that's what we're going to talk about, America. You have freedom of choice, and if that's what you want to choose, okay. Now, what I mean by the future of the American dream is whether or not many of the basic ideals and the values which we believe hold the country together really are going to be adequate to keep the country together in the near future. Because any society depends on the citizens sharing the same ideals and goals and values so that we're not constantly or literally at each other's throats. I can only give you a couple of examples of what I mean by this. You take, for instance, Northern Ireland, or you take Lebanon, would be two current examples, or South Africa would be another one, where the population does not agree on what the basic values, goals, and ideals of the society should be. And therefore, they are literally at war with one another, and the destructiveness, of course, is beyond our imagination. I mentioned once I have a colleague in our department. His office is just 3 doors down. He's from Lebanon, and he's an American citizen now, but he tells things that we don't get in the stories. He tells stories that we don't get in newspapers about the unbelievable destruction. What is it when you say 300 women and children are killed in a night of, fighting or something like this? That just goes on and on, because a country like Lebanon is so terribly torn apart. But the United States has had a different kind of past, and with the one exception, and that was a whopping big exception, namely the Civil War, and I would very strongly recommend, if you have the chance to read a really fine adventure story, beautifully written, is the novel that Carol is recommending so highly, The Killer Angels. It's marvelously written. You don't have to be a fan of military history, and I'm not at all, but you don't have to be a fan of military history to really enjoy this particular novel. But with that exception, the United States, for the most part, has held together pretty well. That is, when we have disagreements and we have arguments, and we have showdowns and so on, but when we have disagreements and showdowns and arguments, we don't go to war over it. as you would, for instance, in other countries, or we learned somehow how to cooperate. Somehow we made it through, for instance, the 1960s. We even made it through 1968. I shared the other night this impression, and I remember other people had it too, that watching the Democratic National Convention, I remember in 68, I really thought everything really was coming unglued. I really thought, I didn't, you know, was there going to be a United States the next day? I really felt this, because there were, it looked so hopeless at that particular time. But somehow we pulled through. But the reason, what I'm suggesting is that one reason we survived as well as we have, granted all the difficulties, and I'm not going to minimize those at all, that the one reason we've survived is that basically we've agreed on the general principles by which our society should be governed. And I suppose the best expression of this would be the Declaration of Independence. If you had to pick one document which expresses what all of us would say, that's it, so far as, you know, America is concerned, it would be the Declaration of Independence. And one of the good things about the Declaration is that it is kind of general and a little bit vague, so people on all levels of the spectrum can agree with it. Liberals, conservatives, moderates, whatever those things, extremists on all sides can agree basically with the Declaration of Independence as to what the goals, the values, the ideals of the society should be. But it goes beyond that, because the Declaration of Independence expresses primarily what we would call, you know, our political ideals, our goals and all the rest. And what I want to talk about today is not so much whether or not these goals or ideals, that's a better word, have a future, because obviously I think they do. There's no question that anybody is seriously questioning freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, you know, freedom of worship. All of these things are so well established, although there's controversy of how they should be, you know, expressed. But what I would like to talk about is whether or not another part of the American dream, namely our ideas especially about economic opportunity and the way in which we can find fulfillment as a people through our work, whether or not the old ideals, namely the Protestant work ethic, is what I'm talking about specifically here, has much of a future in our country. And I only want to go through how it got started, basically what it is, and then show a couple of the problems so far as what it might be, what might be some of the questions for the future. Because what the big question I'm asking, and I don't know, you know, there's no final answer to this, at least in the immediate future, is whether or not with our economic values and ideals, whether or not we've promised too much in America, whether or not America actually has promised too much. Maybe one of the reasons that we have so many difficulties today, is all I'm saying, is that we have such high expectations as to what should happen in America, that when they become, when we don't realize these, when we fall short of what we've been told or promised America is really all about, then we start looking for scapegoats, and we start looking for solutions which are, and we become rather cynical and rather, that's the best word, such has been the case, I think, in the United States in the last 2 or 3 years. Let me give you one very homely but personal example of what I'm getting at here. When I graduated from high school, I got, you know, the old pep talk from my father, and I can remember it so well, and he said, "Remember, son, there's always room for one more good one at the top." The idea being there that if you have ability and talent and hard work and persistence and all these things, there's always room for one more good one right up at the top. And I'm wondering if, you know, if that's the case any longer, because obviously the point he was trying to make was you better go out there and get on top and be successful and achieve. And I'm not knocking it. I'm just wondering, you know, if that's the direction in which we can continue to move in the future. Now, what's more complicating about the American dream so far as economic opportunity is concerned is that we don't look in this country at work simply as a means of providing enough money to, you know, keep alive and get a little security and get an education for the children and provide a little security for old age. But from the very beginning in America, we have looked at work as a very explicit part of our religious obligation. That is to say that, let's see if I can get zeroed in on this, that work in this country is not, as I say, simply a means of earning enough money or exchanging services for for pay or something else like this, but it is a means of fulfilling what we consider to be our obligations to God. The Puritans really started this, and what's interesting, and we've speculated this on this a lot. I know Nancy took the course, and we're still asking this question, Nancy, with Cliff Nelson and I. What if America had been founded, let's say, by Lutherans instead of by Calvinists? And it makes all the difference in the world, really, that the United States was founded by Calvinists rather than by Lutherans or Episcopalians, in that case Anglicans, if you like, to be a purist, or Catholics, because Puritan Calvinists, and I'm talking here especially about the Puritan variety of Calvinists, had a very clear, expressly worked out doctrine of work, and how work was really a means not only of fulfilling an obligation to God, but to serve God and to expand the kingdom of God. And that's what I'd like to talk about briefly as sort of is maybe one of the problems that we have for today. Because the Puritans believed that very strongly, the place to start really, in the idea that everything that happened in life has a theological explanation, that there was nothing that took place in this world that couldn't be explained apart from it belonging to a master scheme somewhere in the in the providence of God. His eye is on the sparrow understanding, and that therefore work along with play, along with everything else, had to have a theological explanation. And looking in the New Testament, they came up with the idea of what we call the doctrine of stewardship, that the way in which we serve God and the way in which we can expand the kingdom of God and carry it out in the Great Commission from Matthew is to take our two talents and turn them into four, or our five talents and turn them into ten. And you know what happened to the one person who had the one talent and buried it, and so on. So what I'm saying is that the Puritans had this idea from the very beginning that since they were to really establish the New Jerusalem, they were coming to this new world to show really what God had in mind for this world at this time. They didn't dare fail. That's the point. They didn't dare fail, because if they failed, if it didn't succeed, that would mean that they were wrong, that their theology was wrong, and they couldn't believe that. They couldn't imagine that their whole theological framework was in error. And that therefore, from the very beginning, they had to do their very best, and they had to succeed. God was testing them. God was challenging them. Just think, for instance, if you were of the Pilgrims, the first group that came over right in 1620, over half of them died the first year. This is sometimes overlooked. This is, they landed at Plymouth and in November, and if you've ever been in around Plymouth or Boston in November, well, don't. That's all I'm saying, but, the nor'easters that come in, and they had to live in the Mayflower and then come ashore in the day and so on, and over half of them died in the winter. And rather than give up, they took this as a sign that God was testing them, that God wanted to really prove to them that if they lived up to their end of the bargain, he would live up to his end of the bargain. They believed very strongly in this idea of what they call the covenant or the contract, that if they turned two talents into four, if they turned five talents into ten, then God would richly reward and bless them. And the way in which they knew God had richly rewarded and blessed them was economic success. This was a sign. God didn't leave them in doubt. God didn't play games. God didn't hold back on anything. There wasn't anything really hidden about how God told them what his will was for them. And therefore, in order to prove that they were doing God's will, in order to live up to this challenge which God had given them, in order to prove that the kind of life that they had was truly God's will, they didn't dare do anything except their very best. I like to read, Nancy was in the class, I like to read the hymn, I wish I had it here. It's a perfect Puritan hymn, "Work for the Night is Coming." Starting off work in the morning, work in the noonday, and work in the evening, and other little things. The devil has use for idle fingers, and this idea of always striving, working, sacrificing, and all these things, which goes along with it. Work for the Night is Coming. I could sing it if you like, but I think that might set back music of Holden 15 years. So I always like to say my brother got all the musical talent in our family and I got all the brains. So that was the way, the Lord divided it up. And I thought it was a good choice. But anyway, I can't sing. I have to put that in a plug, though, defensively here of a brother who can very well. But anyway, work with the work ethic. Now, here is where we run into a little trouble, and here's where the Puritan idea breaks down, not really due to their fault. The Puritans believed then that work and hard work, the very best work, was what God expected from them, all right? And the way you measured your success was how successful you were in business. It was easy to measure how successful the farmer was because you could see the crops, the livestock, whatever it might be, that were produced there. It was easy to see, for instance, how successful a carpenter could be because you could see these sort of things. But how do you measure success, say, if you were a businessman, if you were investing and so on? You did this by maximizing your profits. You did this by making the largest amount of money profitable. Just like, and that was a proof of your success because that's the way you tested yourself. If you were clever, if you were disciplined, if you, you know, if hard work, thrift, denial, instant gratification, all of these things were ways by which you proved to the world that you were a success. And by having proved that you were a success, then obviously you had proved that God had chosen you to be, to be among the elect, and you were doing His will. All right. Furthermore, we had the Puritans had to cope with the fact, besides that one, why should it be once they got over the first few years and they got over simply survival like the Pilgrims did in the first couple of years, why should it be that there were no major obstacles in their way so far as economic opportunity was concerned? Why suddenly should all this tremendous bounty be there? I know what we say today about the Native Americans being there and everything else, but I don't want to get started on that because that just gets us off in an entirely different direction. And the Puritans, for the most part, when they didn't have to kill the Indians, just ignored them. A few, like John Eliot, tried to convert them, but it didn't work too well. But since there is a, remember we said before, there was a theological explanation for everything, there had to be a theological explanation for why all this bounty, why all this richness, why this good land, the favorable climate, the resources of the forest, the big, which, and there was a tremendous market, of course, for fur in the old world at the time, for fish. The Puritans didn't at all mind selling fish to Catholic Europe. They might have thought that the Pope was the Antichrist, but so long as the Pope saw to it that there was a good market for fish, they would go along with the Antichrist at least to that degree. But why all this kind of economic the resources? The answer must be, you see, that God wanted them to be successful, that God wanted them to prosper, that God was showing them what should be done now, and that they would therefore be the chosen people living in the new Garden of Eden, the cornucopia, the land of plenty. This is why we always identify Thanksgiving with the Puritans, because of the idea of bounty and then the gratitude that comes for the bounty which was theirs. And therefore, when they saw this opportunity, they didn't see it. This is the point. The original Puritans didn't see it as a form of simply adding as much wealth as possible to their own income, but rather as a means of turning two talents into four, five into ten, to show, the greater glory, to reflect the greater glory of God. Because it indicated that God was living up to his end of the bargain. They were working, they had put in their time, their thrift, their investment and everything else, and in their belief that a contract is a two-way thing, since they were doing, fulfilling their end of the bargain, then the Lord was providing, fulfilling his end of the bargain, or the covenant, if you like to. If you like to put it in those terms. And therefore, in America from the beginning, their idea was established that in order to be a good citizen, in order to really live up to the demands and the expectations from God, that you should be as prolific a producer in the economic realm as possible. And one other thing that's oftentimes overlooked is that that you had every reason to expect that that was what belonged to you, that you you should be grateful for what God has given, but on the other hand you should expect that you will be rewarded for this, that there was actually a concrete expression of bounty and bounty that God would give you for this. And once you get this idea that you're entitled to be wealthy so long as you obey certain rules or games, then you see you have a whole new ball game started altogether. Because then what happens, and I can go on at long length on this, then what happens is that Every person, no matter where you come from, no matter what your pedigree is, no matter what your background in terms of peasant, middle class, aristocracy, royalty, whatever it might be, every person is entitled to the to share in the great bounty and the wealth of this country. And once you start believing in that, then obviously you've really reversed the course of history, because in Europe for such a long period of time, the idea was that you were simply born into your class or caste or whatever it was in life, and you should simply be satisfied with this. The very wealthy were always fond of quoting this, one verse of that's been so terribly misused, of Jesus, "The poor you will always have with you." And therefore, since Jesus said that, then that settled it. Once and for all, and that the poor deserved what they had in life because they didn't show enough industry and hard work and the virtues of God, and the qualities that God expected from people. But the idea grew up in this country because of the enormous economic opportunity that was there, that with hard work, industry, thrift, and all this, that you too could be entitled to the good life. And therefore, the basic thrust of the American dream was that so long as you lived up to the values which I've outlined here, the hard work, the thrift, the denial of instant gratification and all the rest, so long as you obeyed the rules and the laws, that you would be rewarded. All right, now the question, no matter where you came from. Now what's happened, just to jump into the where I'd like to get into the discussion, is we've found that we are suffering in a very real sense from the success in that way of the system. I know the system has been a disaster for many people, the minorities and all that, which we can't keep flagellating ourselves forever on that. But what, in a very real sense, what's happened, I suppose, especially since World War II, and we had to produce such an enormous system to get the war material out for World War II and all the rest, that it had greatly accelerated economic growth, is that we are really seeing the backlash, if you like, to many of the earlier ideas that we simply took for granted before. Because now we're finding that there are very serious limitations to economic growth. That growth in and of itself is not necessarily going to absorb the frustrations and the desires of people who didn't have the economic wealth that the more wealthy people had before, but who want the opportunity to make as much money as people who have greater economic wealth now have. That, in other words, contrary to what my father told me, this is what I'm saying, there isn't necessarily room at the top anymore for one more good one. And that therefore a lot of people are in a very difficult position, because what they've been told is the reward for hard work, thrift, energy, investment, all of these things really in a very real sense are becoming counterproductive. In some places where we vastly overproduced. In other places, we don't know what to do with unemployment. Even though we have about 7.5 million people, that's such a fantastic figure, it's unbelievable. Even though many people want to, other people who are unemployed really want to work. We're with this. We don't know what to do because the whole American dream, such as I've outlined it, depended on an endless cornucopia, an endless land in which resources would be virtually inexhaustible. And now, really for the first time, really I suppose in about the last 10, 15 years, we're beginning to wonder whether or not the ideal of incentive, of encouraging people to work hard, to produce, to maximize profits, is really in harmony with what we consider to be the best interests of society. And the final complicating factor, I think, that I probably could have mentioned before, but fits in here just as well, I think, is that the American dream is no longer something which affects only Americans, because now, as Al says in his Declaration of Interdependence, that what we do is something which affects the whole world. And that therefore, no matter what we might think we might want to do so far as our own economic future is concerned, no matter what we do, the rest of the world is going to be directly and drastically affected by this. Just the whole thing with the exchange of grain, for instance, with Russia is a very good example of this, on how the whole idea has changed. So what I'm trying to suggest, and I'll just leave it here, leave it at this point, and hope we can start discussion, is I'm not sure in terms of our economic future that the American dream, that there's always more room at the top for one more good one, is practical or viable any longer. And I'm not quite sure we know where to go or what to put in its place. I don't know what to tell my son, for instance. I'm not going to tell him there's room at the top for one more good one, because of all the different kinds of pressures and demands which are on us all the time. Does that make any sense, what I'm trying to say? And maybe we need a new manifesto, maybe we need a new set of ideals, or don't we? Do you think the appeal to economic, to individual initiative, hard work, thrift is good enough? I mean, can still succeed? Or are we in a position where we may have to move towards more collective, you know, interdependence? Not everybody at once. Yeah.
Yeah, we kind of go along with what Al said last night. I would go along with that to a certain extent, but the old Puritan idea that work be an explicit part of religious obligation, I can still see that, even though we do go to a more collective interdependent, not to be the elect that gets to the top, but that work is part of your religious almost obligation as a human being.
Wasn't that work debased for a while? I mean, work when you were a craftsman, when you had something that was really self-fulfilling, was much more rewarding than when it got to be drudgery or assembly line sort of thing. Then I don't know if that has much resemblance to what the
idea. That's another big topic. I'd be glad to explore that with us, because many of us here, and not you individually, but people who are in our friends, are not people who work day in and day out in factories and have a little more opportunity for human contact, I suppose you could say, communication, which isn't quite so regularized. But how in the world can you make work interesting or meaningful or a part of one's way of serving God when it has become, you know, completely routine?
I guess what I was going to suggest then is that would be the part that we should retain, is that kind of work, and maximize that kind of work again, that is really something that a person feels fulfilled by doing, rather than just work for the sake of a work ethic or something.
Yeah, there's a lot more to work than just obligation. It's work can be meaningful and much satisfying the soul, good for the common good.
But in a way, aren't the pressures, or many of the pressures we face, such that they don't really sort of reward or celebrate work anymore, but now it's how soon Friday comes?
Isn't there a change in thinking to quality in work instead of quantity?
I don't see that.
Not right now, at least where I work, you know, as a simple sales clerk, and the businessmen come in and have their session in the morning. It's quantity, how much you can sell, X on the floor, X out, so you can sell. Doesn't matter if they like the dress, doesn't matter if they just business. And it just makes me angry. It makes me terribly angry, because I could not possibly sell something to someone just for the sake of...
You don't always want to listen to a salesman.
Just to serve the great... I don't know how to say it in English, but what makes me very angry is that so many big American businessmen owning those big corporation that's opening up those big shopping centers and killing the small businesses and having it in Australia and in Germany, West Germany.
Multinationals,
yeah. It's evil. I mean, for me, they can't even use this money for themselves. And that man who just died, what was his name? He was a beautiful man. Yes. When I look at his picture, when he was a young, beautiful man and could have any woman, and most probably he enjoyed that, and all the money in his world, it didn't mean anything. He could get everything he wanted to, but I wonder what he thought at the end of his life.
Yeah.
How little he had.
Joan, you were going to...
Back to the young man over here, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's young man, that's what he said thank you for, yeah.
That was really good, because this is where we are now. Even the housewife, or whatever she gets out of that work, if she's to bake bread or whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I think work is therapeutic, isn't it?
Hopefully.
You know, with all the young people laying around doing nothing, and a lot of them out there and doing and all of that.
There we go.
All kinds of work. And they would rather work. They work harder trying to get out of work than going ahead and doing something.
Don't blame it on the young people.
Well, that's a crutch. I don't like that.
But I believe that the corporations that are squeezing out the little man. The little corner grocer, right around where I live, we used to have 5. And, you know, you could get something, ice cream cone or whatever, in the evening. You can't, there aren't any.
No.
Because they can't compete.
But, you see, in a way, that's what I'm asking. In a way, we've chosen the big supermarkets. We've chosen the big shopping centers.
I haven't.
Do you shop there? Or do you still go to some... little neighborhood store where
there
prices are.
Neighborhood store to go to.
Well,
I have no choice.
They would be there if you would have.
If everybody had stayed, yeah, because there's nothing. Yeah.
I went to them.
People chose to go to the big shopping centers, and therefore, in this idea of freedom of choice that we say we have in America, they've chosen to do, you know, to do that.
Yeah, but I think some of our laws favor the big ones. They have loopholes and tax-wise and everything.
Yeah, yes,
that helps them along the way.
I hesitate to make this political, but I think one of the reasons the young people aren't working in the minorities as well is because we have minimum wage laws, which make it impractical to allow young and unskilled people to gain experience by which they can move up the ladder in the old Puritan ethic.
Mm-hmm.
It's now become impossible. So that they hire people with a college education, for instance, to be clerks or whatever, because that's a qualification that they can state, and things are so bad they can get people like that, so that there's not much room for unskilled people, even though they don't need this qualification, it's simply available.
I agree with you, because I know kids that were working, high school children, that were working during the summer. And then the union stepped in and said, well, they've got to join a union. And so they were, well, as the people checked out their things, and they were putting things in sacks, you know, they had that job, or carry them off to the cars. They are no more, because they made them pay union dues.
Okay. What can we do, though, you think about making work more meaningful and less, you know, just something you have to do? Because the whole thrust, for instance, of most advertising is you know, towards consumption of leisure goods. Just here, I get the Wenatchee station, and weekends are made for Michelob. Is a good example of this sort of thing. Therefore, you can really live. You only drink. Back in Minnesota, we used to have one called Lindenkugel or something, you know, it's sort of a poor man's beer on the weekdays, but on the weekends you can really live because Michelob's more expensive. But how do you, you know, and isn't it in Thursday, in the public schools, Thursday is called hump day, because if you get through Thursday, you're over the hump for the week and it's just coasting down, and
it's Wednesday.
Wednesday is hump day. Oh, if it gotten back to Wednesday, pretty soon it'll be Tuesday.
Wednesday
is hump day.
They call it a hump day.
Is it because, in a sense, we've been promised, you know, to come back to my original question, so much that work should be meaningful and should be exciting and all the rest, and for most of us, it really isn't, unless there are some few people. You know, I have to go to committee meetings, and it's not work in a physical sense. I think mental torture is worse than physical torture, and that's committees. But is it that we've been promised so much because we've had this American ideal of hard work and thrift, and all of a sudden we get out there and bust our butts, and you know, nothing much. It just becomes kind of drudgery. I don't know. I'm just asking, Nancy.
I think that's pretty true. One thing I was talking about, why are people like caretakers and, you know, when they come on maintenance engineers or, you know, janitors,
yeah,
and stuff like that, why are they always such neat people? You know, like every school has the janitor, the beloved janitor.
Andy here.
Yeah, Andy. You know, everything has that. And I think that it's because those jobs are not considered fulfilling work. And so the people that get jobs like that are, you know, basically cleaning up after everybody else with really awful jobs, they have to use their imagination to make it go. And those are the ones that really contribute.
And another thing, they're not competitive jobs, which is a good thing, because they're jobs in which you do your job and that's it, and nobody's breathing down your neck. And you don't have to do extra things and worry, you know, is the boss watching me? That's the thing that used to bother me the most, you know, evaluation all the time.
I think it might be more important to say that they're in charge.
Yeah.
The kind, not all of them, but the ones you're talking about, I think, are the ones that are responsible, and nobody tells them when to do what. They make those decisions. They have pride in it because of that.
Yeah, I think that's true. Or another way of looking at it is responsibility, that they take a personal responsibility for what they're doing, but somehow our system seems to not reward, but simply, you know, create a way in which everybody passes the buck. And until you become like Andy here, who really isn't satisfied until he really solves the problem himself and does it himself and is proud of what he does, it just gets to be a matter of passing the buck. And you can't identify with your job, because there seems to be so many sort of impersonal forces at work beyond your control. Yes, here.
Oh, and one thing I have said that they are doing quite a bit in Europe now is they have made working days more flexible, insofar as you put in your 40-hour week and you have to be there during 5 hours.
Right.
You can to sleep, but you are not on a time card or anything like that, but it is your responsibility to put in the hours, and the employers have found that people use much less sick leave and they
yes.
work much better.
I've heard, for instance, there might be like a 12-hour continuum, I guess that's the word, in which you can come in at the beginning, or, you know, if you're an early morning person, or towards the end if you're a later afternoon person, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And another one apparently that's working very good too is the 10-hour, 4-day week. Because if you got those 4 days, get them over with. Or other ones that are leading to a point are that where the workers are seriously consulted as to really what should be done, and they can see that there are results on the basis of their input. There's a marvelous bank in Washington, D.C., where nobody gets more than a certain salary, and they have a weekly session or a weekly whatever it is, in which tellers, assistant cashiers, the vice presidents, all the rest, really work the whole thing out. And everybody really understands exactly what everybody else is getting. And there's, you know, some bruised egos once in a while, but for the most part, they like their work because they're treated as human beings. I think that's the clue. The clue is, and how do you do that? No, you obviously are not treated as a human being.
Well,
in your...
I'm treated as a human. I work really in a small outfit, you know.
Yeah.
It's really a very small outfit. But still, it's, you know, it's business. I couldn't see myself really Keppels or Pennies or I think I would be fired from it.
Yeah.
Because I just, yeah, but it is business. I wondered, you know, I thought about, even so in America it might be impossible, but like my sister writes from Germany, from Dresden, Germany, which is the East Section.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, she just bought a home And she had to give, I don't know, was it 43 or something, each husband and wife have to give so and so many hours free first before they can buy this home. You know, they have to show the certificate. And then also, you know, I ask her questions, and funny that she was allowed even to write this all. How it is, you know, that here, for instance, that's how we get rich. Like, we can buy 3, 4, 5 homes, and then we can sell it to anyone we want to. We get, you know. But over there, she wrote that she is allowed, that they are allowed to sell to give the home to the children, and the children give it to the children. Mm-hmm. But if there were no children, then it would go back to the government. Mm. They were not allowed to sell it. And of course, that's how the system can stay, and the prices can stay in 63, the same prices. And, but I wonder if that's ever, maybe, I mean, in a small sense,
something like that here?
Ever would be possible.
Yeah, the money that how we think about.
That, so there could not develop such, you know, such stone-rich people and very poor, you know.
Some way of redistributing, this will blow somebody's people on, redistributing the wealth? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's almost impossible because, you see, there nobody ever was really wealthy. A doctor is middle class, you know, middle high class.
Yeah.
I never knew any high class.
upper class, that's a better
you
word.
You know, upper class.
In English, yeah.
It's very hard to get in touch with that upper class, or who, I never met any upper class. Maybe the priest, the pastor is upper class. I don't know, it might be impossible for them.
Yeah.
I guess it's possible.
Salaries have run away. It's unfortunate there are politicians in Washington who really have such high salaries when all of them have the sidelines of their job. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of Washington with a feeling of honor of what they can do for us, that we can respect them without not respecting anybody anymore. There's no respect.
No respect, you said then.
Well, you see, in a way, that's what we wanted. That's the system we've created, because we've decided that your salary is the measure or the sign to the world of what you're worth.
That's
right.
It's the measure of success.
Yeah, money is the measure of success, really. And many good people, I would, you know, disagree a little, because many good people stay out of government because they don't get the salaries that they could get somewhere else. And
yes, but most of those do have their own business someplace operating.
Yeah, they've got, I really think they've got conflict of interest things down pretty well under control now, where you can't vote yourself, you know, for your own self-interest or something. And I can, you know, there's enough balance, like McGovern and Nixon, for instance, just to take the two from 72, had no, both came from very, you know, simple origins and so on. And we're able to, you know, get to the very highest thing. Same thing is true for Carter or for Ford, and so on. I'm put it this way. As long as we value money so highly, I think there should be that kind of incentive. Otherwise, we will be attracting people who will see government office as the main means of making money. There was one thing that was absolutely right about appointing Nelson Rockefeller as vice president. That you couldn't bribe him the way Agnew was bribed, because who could bribe a Rockefeller? He didn't need it, you see. And I think that's important, that they are, you know, that's taking a low view of human nature, but you know, that's the way people are. And if you pay them enough, they're not going to be subject to the kinds of pressures that they have. Or some people, like Mark Hatfield, for instance, has no special income, and he has to go out and give addresses. I think it's $1,000 a speech or something. I don't know if anybody here is from Oregon, but usually we have some Oregon people. I think it's about $1,000, but he has to, because he had no, you know, he's not Jacob Javits, or he's not who else you could, you know, some other people you could mention who have considerable fortunes, like, say, probably Stevenson of Illinois. And I don't know how else to do this, because we take such a dim, you know, we have a very suspicious view of politicians. So unless we can somehow, I suppose you have to say they have to earn their, you know, earn respect, but many of them do, you know, deserve respect, and yet until they get their satisfactions from that job well done, we aren't going to get good people until...
A lot of rich men do philanthropic work we don't even love.
Yeah.
It's tricky what they do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, some of those salaries, $5 steaks can easily be bought, no problem, you just didn't buy them.
Yeah.
Somebody else came to eat.
Yeah.
And they don't realize what little man is getting. He can't do it after a while. He's so used to spending his dollars.
Oh, I see.
You lose sight.
That's true. That's a possibility that you get you lose touch, and the only thing you can say there is that they do have to stand for re-election again. And if they don't, Larry can say if you want to. I don't want to ask you, but if you want to say something about, do you feel since you have to go back to the for re-election again that keeps you closer to the people?
Yeah, you really haven't been thinking about that because many people don't seem to follow.
You think your constituents follow your work pretty carefully?
Do what?
I was talking to Larry here. He serves in the South Dakota State Legislature.
Well, I don't, except for a very few emotional issues, they really don't.
They don't, yeah. Gun control or...
Yeah, something that really gets tossed around in the papers a lot. We don't have any income tax. We don't have any income tax. So that kind of thing, but...
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. I think the real problem is not, this is one manifestation of it, but the real problem is how do we find rewards to bring out the best in people so that they really take pride in their work? Like craftsmen, you were mentioning this, because that's like, or Andy does in his kind of work, because if you don't have that sort of pride in your work, you are going to become a buck passer and count the hours until you're over the hump.
But I'm not. This young man over here's idea is a good one.
Young man, right. reinforcement, a supportive community, right.
Our system destroys that too, because at any point that some technology points out a way that a machine can produce the product for less money than what a labor-oriented type product is now producing it, that guy and that whole class of people are going to be replaced again. I'm very much of a pessimist in this whole area.
Yeah, I was.
To our future.
I grew up in family farm country, and last year after I'd been here, and we drove back again on 90, I guess it is, and we saw these huge feeder farms out here, west here. I just couldn't believe it, because we grew up where 160 acres really was, the ultimate, and it still is, terribly important. And now we see as more people move to the cities. And all the rest, we see more empty, all the old decaying gray buildings and all the rest, and they're coming in, and it's something serious, something very important is being lost. I think it's getting time, but one last comment here.
One thing that distresses me about our American dream is, I suppose it's the corporations, multinational corporations. The successful ones have become so hard-driving, hard-drinking, hard-pushing, they die young, and it's all a kind of a frightening culture that
we're out of control.
Yeah, really, the achievement syndrome is a very real, it's an illness, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why men are dying earlier than women, which is a reversal from 100 years ago.
Don't you think degrees are taking too great a place? I come from banking. And the young men that come in there, unless they have a college degree, they don't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I can look back to when I started with banking, and our comptroller had gone to the 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And that bank never made a move without consulting me. And I bet he knew 10 times more than anyone that's coming in now with a degree.
Yeah.
His judgment and everything else. Now the kids come in, they want to start at the top. And with the high school students going into college and they can't read, a diploma don't need it.
But that's because society says that you're not a success unless you have that kind of money. It's not because they're young, it's simply because that's where the goodies are handed out. And so long as that's the case, the rat race, will go on. And what Al is trying to do for one here is to reverse the priorities, and take more time for leisure, take more time for contemplation, get away from, all this. I was into this myself. I wrote 5 books in 6 years, and suddenly I realized the world was going to go on. I didn't write one for 1 year, and it was a nice feeling. and the world is still going around. And maybe, you know, because I was losing something, I wasn't spending enough time with the family and all the rest of these things, and Al is trying to get that message across. Larry?
Well, I'm concerned here that our discussion has been sort of a fun and games attack on the very wealthy or very influential. If I forget the figures, but if all of the income of the top 5% in the nation were confiscated in taxes that only run the government, I think it's 2 days.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a masses of us, and everyone in this room is a part of the syndrome that may bring us down.
Unless we blow the whistle on our standard of living, our lifestyle, cutting back, you know, buying small cars, having, you know, smaller houses, clothing, the rest of these things,
but
uses of energy.
But even in that, we're trapped because
even though
I am trying to deal with changing our lifestyle, my debt says that debt will be serviced.
Yeah.
And so, you know, corporations are facing debts to the stockholders. Colleges are facing debts to the bank. It's just an immense trap that...